From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. The honeybee population declined slightly in the United States from 2016 to 2017. That's according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The most often reported colony stressor, Varroa mites. Colony collapse disorder, a separate phenomenon, also went up slightly from 2016 to 2017, but the stressors that cause honeybees to die fall into roughly four categories, according to one of my guests today. Colony collapse disorder is only one of those causes. The notion that this little understood phenomenon is decimating the honeybee population is only one of several often repeated narratives that seems to maintain its traction. So what are the factors threatening honeybees? They fall into roughly four categories: parasites and pathogens, pesticides, and nutritional deprivation from habitat loss and the movement towards monocultures. But it's nuanced. While pesticides are killing honeybees, a recent study by scientists at the University of Texas at Austin suggests the active ingredient in one of the most prolific pesticides, Roundup, doesn't directly kill bees. It harms their gut microbiome, which, as NPR reports, leaves them more susceptible to infection and death from harmful bacteria. To help us understand all of this, we have with us today David Tarpey. He is a professor of entomology and plant pathology at North Carolina State University. He's also the Cooperative Extension State Apiculturist, and he joins us via Skype. Professor Tarpey, welcome to Coastline.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Colleen Higgins is first director of the New Hanover County Beekeepers Association and describes herself as a hobbyist beekeeper. Colleen Higgins, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you on this Thursday. Do you keep bees in the Cape Fear region? What are some of the challenges you face? We can't take phone calls during this live Thursday edition because of the pledge drive, but you can email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Professor David Tarpey, help us understand this. We've heard for several years now that colony collapse disorder is killing honeybees. If it continues, global food production will be thrown into chaos. Is that a little hyperbolic, perhaps? Can you put this in perspective for us?
Sure. I think at this time it would be a bit hyperbolic to say that. At the time when it was first described and elucidated, it was unclear if the phenomenon was going to get worse or kind of sweep through the entire managed honeybee population. There was a lot of uncertainty at the time. The point is that colony collapse disorder didn't seem to progress and get worse and proliferate. In fact, it seems to have abated quite a bit, but it's also allowed a further discussion about all of the other stressors that beekeepers and honeybees have been dealing with that you just mentioned in your opening there, and trying to balance all of those stressors and other reasons why colonies die in addition to colony collapse disorder.
Okay, and I want to get into in just a moment what we know about colony collapse disorder and what it is. But first, Colleen Higgins, you have talked about how you started beekeeping in the 1980s, and it was a hobby for you and something you really enjoyed. Not to say you don't enjoy it now, but then you restarted in the early aughts, and you described it as being more stressful and more worrisome. Can you just talk about the difference as a hobbyist beekeeper between the 1980s and the early 2000s?
It's a lot more hands-on now. I mean, you have to do a lot more with your bees. You have to monitor them a little bit more. You have to treat them. I know lots of people that have gone into it without the idea of doing any kind of treatments or anything, and it's really almost impossible to do that now because of the problems that honeybees are up against. And so it's a lot more involved, and yeah, a little bit more stressful.
And so do you find that you have more die-offs over the winter than you did in the 1980s?
Yes, if you don't follow through with your management, yes.
Professor Tarpey, so let's look then at these four buckets, I guess, of stressors, even though if we put them in buckets, they're not intersectional, but you say they are. All of these factors kind of
impact each other and threaten the bee population. So what are the big categories?
So the big categories are parasites and pathogens, things that make bees sick, right? So disease agents and parasites that feed on the bees as hosts, and then pesticides. So environmental contaminants that the bees can pick up as they're out foraging on flowers and then bringing back to their hive can really interact with their health overall. The third is the nutritional stress. So not having as many flowers, which are, of course, the honeybees' food sources for nectar and pollen, their carbohydrate and protein sources respectively. And then the fourth area is the kind of the population genetics of honeybees and how that intersects all of those other things. And so the interactions among all of these major categories are really quite profound. For example, there have been studies that have shown that bees exposed to particular pesticides or herbicides can be more susceptible to parasites and vice versa, right? So how these things interact is incredibly complex and is very situational, so that you can have one combination of stressors in one location and just a few miles down the road you can have a completely different combination of stressors, which makes it really hard to universalize any sort of ways to mitigate those.
So when we look at something like colony collapse disorder, is that kind of an umbrella term? What does that actually mean? And what do we not understand about that yet? How does that fit into all of this?
Well, so when bees die from a particular disease agent, they have particular symptoms that beekeepers are very familiar with and can usually ascribe the reason why their colony died to that reason. Colony collapse disorder came up about 10 years ago where bees were dying in very noticeably different ways, and it was unclear. It didn't seem to fit the symptomology of a lot of the quote-unquote usual suspects. And so by digging into it further, a syndrome was defined that was unique to this particular phenomenon, and a working group of honeybee researchers collaborated together to try and list off all of these potential problems over, you know, several dozen potential candidates from pesticides to parasites and everything else. And no one single factor seemed to be associated with this newly described phenomenon of colony collapse disorder, which then has left the majority of the community to realize that it really is an intersection of these various stressors, which again makes it very complicated and hard to finally pinpoint.
So then what are varroa mites? This is what the USDA is calling out as the stressor that's having the biggest impact on honeybees.
Yeah, well, Colleen can tell you that is public enemy number one, two, and three, probably, right? Mm-hmm. In the sense that it is an exotic parasitic mite. So that means it was introduced from Asia, from kind of the sister species of our honeybees. So it kind of jumped ship onto our bees. And because our bees didn't co-evolve with this particular parasite, they don't really have a lot of natural defenses to it, and they're little vampires where they suck the fat bodies and kind of the lifeblood, shall we say, of the honeybees as hosts. And as a result, they're also vectoring a lot of secondary pathogens, mainly viruses, that in combination really results in colonies getting sick. And so without beekeeper intervention, a honeybee colony is almost certainly to succumb to varroa mites. So there's really two types of honeybee colonies, those with varroa mites and those that are about to have varroa mites. And so colony management to try to keep them in check is a lot of what beekeepers do, and why, as Colleen was saying, you used to be able to be a bee haver and not really have to do much, but today you have to be an active beekeeper in order to really help the bees out.
You're listening to Coastline.
So Colleen Higgins, what does a beekeeper do about varroa mites? How do you monitor that? If this is something that is going to happen, if it hasn't happened yet.
Well, you do monitor the amount of mites that you have in your hive. So you have different ways to test to look there. You can see them. That's a little difficult, but you can see them. But you have ways to sample a number of bees and calculate the number, and then determine what when you need to treat. So you do monitor them throughout the season. You're trying to get your bees nice and healthy, or keep them nice and healthy, so they'll make it through the winter.
What do they look like? What would a beekeeper see if?
Well, they're small. The analogy that's used is if you take your hand and you spread it very wide and you put it across your body, that's about the size proportion of a mite on a developing larva. So they are pretty good size on a bee, and if you have several of them on a bee sucking their blood, then it is quite detrimental.
Now, are they sucking, and I don't know if this distinction is important, but I want to be clear. Are they sucking blood? Are they sucking fat? I thought I read somewhere.
I'll let Dr. Tarpey.
And Tarpey, Professor Tarpey, I'll come back to you on that question when we come back from this break.
Sounds good. Yep.
You're listening to Coastline. We're learning about honeybees colony collapse disorder and what scientists know about what is in fact harming the bee population. When we return from the break, we'll hear from some listeners. You can email your own question to coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Honeybees are in a precarious position. Scientists say they're suffering from the effects of habitat loss, pesticides, parasites, colony collapse disorder. With me today to unpack this and answering your questions, Colleen Higgins, she's first director of the New Hanover County Beekeepers Association, and David Tarpey, professor of entomology and plant pathology at NC State. You can weigh in or ask your own question during this live Thursday discussion via email at coastline@whqr.org. Professor Tarpey, just before we went to break, you were about to explain what varroa mites are after when they attack honeybees. What are they feeding on?
Yeah, so they're little vampire mites, right? So they're kind of sucking the lifeblood from both the developing larvae and pupae of the bees, as well as the adult bees. But there's a recent PNAS paper that just came out that really looked at precisely the types of tissues that the varroa mites are feeding on. And while they're not feeding on the equivalent of the honeybee blood, they're actually feeding on the equivalent of the honeybee liver. There's not really a good analogy. They're called the fat bodies. And they're in the abdomens, on either side of the abdomens of the adult and developing bees. And it's kind of where a lot of the protein and other fats and other nutritional things are hanging out inside the bee's body. The hemolymph, or the bee's blood, is kind of just circulating all inside, but the real kind of good stuff, the real nutritional stuff for a parasite like varroa mites, is really there at the fat bodies. And so that's where they seem to be targeting, where they're taking the resources from the bees, which again makes them so insidious and impacts. It doesn't kill the bees, but it weakens them, compromises their immune system, because they don't have that kind of physiological resource to stave off other infections.
So would part of your work be finding answers to the varroa mites? Who is working on that, and what kinds of answers are people pursuing at this point?
Well, there's a lot of people working on it. It's not our mainstay, but again, because all of these things interact with each other, it's hard to not work and address varroa mites in some way. The work that we're doing here at North Carolina State University is to focus more on the pathogens that the varroa mites are vectoring rather than the varroa mites themselves. It's pretty clear that varroa mites don't actually kill the colonies. It's these diseases that they're vectoring that kills the colonies. And so I think Colleen would agree with me that she would be fine if she had her colonies swimming with these varroa mites, but they're still healthy and happy. Yeah. So rather than addressing the vector, we're trying to look at this kind of trinity of, rather than just the varroa and honeybee, we're looking at the trinity and the interactions of varroa, honeybee, and pathogen. So that, for example, if we can select for or foster bees that are more tolerant to these viruses, then by default, they may be more tolerant to the varroa as well. So, but we're just one small lab in a large group internationally trying to address these various issues of how to make bees healthy, just with respect to varroa as well as all of those other things.
You're listening to Coastline. Honeybees are important pollinators. They're facing a multitude of threats. With us to understand this today, David Tarpey. He's a professor of entomology and plant pathology at NC State, and he's the Cooperative Extension apiculturist. Colleen Higgins is here. She's first director of the New Hanover County Beekeepers Association. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. And Tom writes, there's a beekeeper south of Monkey Junction who recently lost 18 hives because the gas station across the street from him had a customer stung by a bee. They sprayed their property and the insecticide drifted, so he lost all his hives. And Tom is asking, what is the liability of the person who sprayed the gas station? Colleen, I know you're not a lawyer. Any thoughts on that? And do you hear stories like this around the Cape Fear region? How common is something like that?
That's a tough one. I don't know that it would be, I don't know what to say on that one.
Yeah.
It'd be hard to point the finger directly at that, but, you know, it's awfully hard. I mean, those bees, they fly a good distance, so they're going to come into contact with problems in a lot of different areas. I don't know if it's as clear-cut as that, but I do know that people do freak out about bees.
So what you're saying is it's possible that the bees died of something else or several factors together.
Maybe several factors together. I don't know enough about what he sprayed.
Sure.
And how close he sprayed and right. All that kind of thing, but I don't know about that.
Fair enough. Yeah,
yeah.
That is a reach. George is asking about honey. What's the difference between regular honey, raw honey, unfiltered honey, and raw and unfiltered honey? So four different types. Professor Tarpey?
Well, that's a lot easier visually and through taste tests, I think. The global answer, though, is just how the honey is processed. Of course, you know, honeybees they collect nectar from flowers. They then ripen it and thicken it and store it in their honeycomb so that they have something to eat during the winter. So contrary to popular belief, they store it for themselves rather than for us beekeepers. But the beekeepers then are able to get it out of the comb, and then by processing it or bottling it in various ways, they have different versions of it, right? So kind of raw and unprocessed is kind of minimally processed, but if it's hyper filtered, then it can be really clean and have a longer shelf life and have a lower likelihood of crystallizing and things like that. So really it comes down to the post-harvesting processing of the different types of honey.
Colleen Higgins, how long does it take if a hobbyist beekeeper started this season to be able to harvest honey?
Well, I mean, there are cases where people will get a new hive in the spring and it will build up. I mean, because when you get a hive, you're starting with a very small number of bees and a queen. There are cases where people haven't built up enough and will harvest honey the first year, but it's usually not something that you would anticipate, that you would probably work on getting your hive nice and strong and be ready for the following year. But sometimes people get it the first year. It just depends.
And how do you know you have a strong hive? How do you know that it's okay to harvest honey that first year?
If they have built up enough numbers and they have enough brood and enough honey for themselves, and then they will go on and you can add on a super for honey, that would be what you would take. But you want to think of your bees first and have your bees be high in numbers and plenty of food stored up to make it through the winter. That should be the first priority.
Jane is asking about, you know, other than becoming a beekeeper and avoiding pesticides, what can an ordinary gardener or homeowner do to help the bee population? And Colleen, I know that you've got some good ideas about that.
Well, I mean, Wilmington is very urban, and if there are going to be bees living in Wilmington, they need to have something to eat, because we cannot count on our native habitat, because it's, as anyone would know, it's slowly going away in Wilmington. So homeowners need to think about what they're going to plant or what they're going to keep and not cut, because bees need food. They need food.
Professor Tarpey, what are some of the plants that you would recommend folks put in their backyards?
Oh, goodness. I'm not a horticulturist. That actually might be best left to the excellent horticulture agents and the cooperative extension all across the state. You have a really good crew right there in Brunswick County as well. But things that by definition are pollen and nectar producing, and a lot of horticultural catalogs and whatnot have those types of things listed now where they're bee friendly. You know, a lot of showy plants are often showy, but they're not bearing in nectar and or pollen. But there's a lot more recommendations now of taking that into consideration. So, you know, check these different guides to see if they're nectar or pollen producing.
Put in a plug for the North Carolina State Beekeepers Association website. Mm-hmm. Under resources, they have it broken down by coastal plain, mountain, mm-hmm. Piedmont. Mm-hmm. They have blooming ranges. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't realize one of our first species is already finished, and that's our red maples. So definitely looking at plants that are going to help honeybees. And like he said, a lot of the landscape plants are not. So look at natives. I think also, too, another thing is be a little mindful to let things go ahead and bloom. I know a lot of people garden. They might plant lettuces and things like that, broccoli, but they are want to get them out of there when they are done with them. And if you left them to let them bloom, those are good things for the honeybees. And let the wild areas along the edge of your property grow up. Dandelions. Nobody wants dandelions in their yard, but they're great for the honeybees.
Great for bees. That's right.
And so there's some serious tension there between what's expected in suburban areas by homeowners associations and neighbors and what's actually good for the environment. So, Professor Tarpey, what's the best way to navigate that tension?
Yeah, I want to comment on that, because you're right. It does go counter to the expectations. But I think we're having more of a discussion and a holistic vantage point of that, of realizing that our yards having this, in essence, sterile green grass that really doesn't do much for bees or you know, other things as well, to making those landscapes much more productive. not just for pollinators, but for other things as well. And so I think our aesthetics may need to change. To me, a beautiful unkempt lawn is a lot more beautiful than than something that requires a lot of inputs of you know, pesticides and fertilizer and everything like that. So I think if we can just think more broadly and to have our landscapes more productive for things like honeybees, I think that might ultimately change our aesthetics and our expectations as well.
Brian from Wilmington writes, it seems that not recklessly and irresponsibly clear-cutting trees and other natural space for apartment complexes, storage unit centers would be great benefit to bees locally. CFPUA just this week, he says, had to answer calls from citizens about taking a stretch of 50-plus-year-old trees. Bees are pressured from all sides, and our city council's laissez-faire attitude towards planning and development is something that needs to be addressed. This is something that will benefit the entire community, not just the bees. Brian says, personally, I usually let my grass grow enough for the clovers and whatnot to bloom for the bees to have some. I fear this is one of those scenarios where our worst estimates for the future are always insufficient. Thanks so much for that, Brian. But it really, I mean, pragmatically, you've got homeowners associations popping up in all of these new developments that are exploding around the Cape Fear region, particularly Brunswick and Pender County. And that is usually the mandated aesthetic, is this perfectly manicured, grassy green lawn.
Mm-hmm.
How do you battle that?
I think personally we need to get a little bit more understanding and a little bit more of nature and a little bit less fearful of nature. Back to your other question, the person got stung by a bee. They immediately wanted to get rid of all the bees around. I think the clear cutting in Wilmington is a horrible situation. I think of areas that I ride by that I always hear a former commentator on HQR, Andy Wood, in my ear saying, that's the most biologically diverse area of New Hanover County, and it's gone. So I don't understand that. I think if we could be a little bit more interested in having a little bit more nature.
You're listening to Coastline. Mike writes, I've been a beekeeper for about 25 years. If you pay attention to your hives and treat them for mites and make sure they have adequate food stores, you shouldn't lose too many colonies from any cause. There will always be honeybees as long as there is money to be made from them. Mike says, the bees I worry about are the natural pollinators. There isn't anyone looking out for them the way they do for honeybees. Once we begin losing our natural pollinators, we are really in trouble. Is anyone monitoring our natural pollinators' health? Professor Tarpey, how many different kinds of bees should we be talking about?
Well, amen. And I really appreciate that point because, you know, honeybees live in colonies of 50,000, you know, bees within a single hive that we provide them. And so they're semi-domesticated, right? We manage them and we can be their stewards and working with them to keep them healthy. Honeybees are, even though they're our state insect, they're actually introduced from Europe. So they're actually imported and did not evolve here. Native bees are incredibly numerous. There are thousands and thousands of species in North America and North Carolina alone. And they are, by and large, solitary. They do not live in colonies. They are not managed by people. They are wild living. They nest in the ground. They nest in twigs and other places around in our environment. And they also provide very, very important pollination services to our crops, to wildflowers and everything else. We just don't have nearly as much of an idea or control over them because they're part of the wild, you know, system. And so there is a huge number of people who are concerned about all pollinators, not just managed pollinators like honeybees. And so because they don't have people looking out for them like beekeepers do for honeybees, they're much more susceptible to a lot of these same problems. There's a lot of things that are unique to honeybees, like varroa mites. They only infest honeybee colonies. But these other native bees, they have their own pathogens and what they're dealing with. They're just as susceptible, if not more so, to pesticides in the environment. They have the same nutritional constraints that when we have clear cutting or deforestation or other things, they also don't have as much food to rely upon. So there's similarities, but there's also differences when it comes to these wild pollinator populations. And you bet, we need to think very holistically about it, not just honeybees in the strict sense, but all pollinators in general.
And so do we know then, and forgive me if you already answered this, but is there a difference then between wild bee habitat or native bee habitat to southeastern North Carolina and what would be good for honeybees here?
Most, I would say that the overlap is 90%+, you know, because wild bees are, they're so varied. Some of them are specialists and they only forage on one particular type of flower. Others, like honeybees, are generalists and they will just go to whatever is kind of available and is most nutritious for them in their flight area. So it really varies a lot. But overall, you know, pollen and nectar in a diversity of different plant sources is good for all bees. And so we should be definitely promoting that.
How do native bees figure into what the new Hanover County Beekeepers Association does, Colleen Higgins? Is that part of it at all, or are you strictly focused on honeybees?
We're strictly focused on honeybees.
Fair enough. But if there is so much overlap between those populations.
Yes. We're honeybee keepers.
Fair enough. And you're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of the plight of the honeybee, what's causing their decline, what people can do about it. NC State Professor David Tarpey and New Hanover County Beekeepers Association Director Colleen Higgins are with us today. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from this short break, we'll have one more segment for you to get your question or comment in. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Honeybees are facing a multitude of threats, from habitat loss to pesticides, parasites and pathogens, colony collapse disorder. They're dying over the winter at higher rates as beekeepers grow them back each year. Here to help us understand what's happening with the honeybee population and what local residents can do to help, David Tarpey. He's professor of entomology and plant pathology at NC State. He's also the cooperative extension apiculturist for the state. Colleen Higgins is first director of the New Hanover County Beekeepers Association. And you can ask your own question during the live discussion on this Thursday by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. It is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. Colleen Higgins, what does it mean when we talk about bees swarming?
Bees, as all species, need to reproduce in order to carry on their genetic information. And so reproduction is very important. And what honeybees do to reproduce and spread their numbers is swarm. So typically this is a time of year. It can be all throughout the season of honeybees, but typically we see a lot of swarming in the spring. And what happens is the hive numbers get very high. They at some point decide that they are going to swarm. And so half the bees will leave from that hive with the queen. She goes with them. And they go away from the hive, and they usually will stop somewhere near on a branch or on a car exhaust, wherever. They can be in lots of different places, but they will cluster as a ball. So if you're very fortunate to see such a thing, it's quite interesting. You'll see a big bunch of bees hanging together, maybe the size of a football or bigger, depends on the number, and they will cluster there while scout bees go out looking for a new home. And they may stay in that location for a day or 2 days while they scout around looking for a new home. They may be looking for a hole in your house. They might be looking for a hole in a tree or various places. When they decide, they will reach consensus and they will all fly into the new home. So as a beekeeper or as a homeowner, if you see such a thing, we get calls and people will say, I have these bees here. I don't want them, but I don't want to kill them, which is fantastic. Call a beekeeper. Call the New Hanover County Beekeepers Association. A beekeeper will come out there. If they can capture the queen and the bees, they can start a new hive of bees. And most people would prefer them to do that rather than go into a house, because they do that sometimes.
Professor, yeah, Kathy. I should also mention that if there's a silver lining to colony collapse disorder, you know, when I first started, I would get calls all the time, as I'm sure the New Hanover beekeepers did too, and saying, mm-hmm. well, how do I kill these things?
Yes.
And now there's been this massive public awareness campaign about the importance of honeybees and other pollinators, native bees included. And so now we get those calls saying, how can I save them? I don't want to hurt them. And so I think there's a real benefit. If there is a silver lining to colony collapse and the other plights of bees, that would be it.
You know, I'm just fascinated by this notion that they swarm, they make a decision, they look, somebody goes out, they scout locations, and bees come back and they talk to each other somehow, and they make this collective decision and then travel together to the new home. Professor Tarpey, can you shed some light on how they communicate? What do we know about how they talk to each other?
We know an incredible amount. In fact, there was a Nobel Prize awarded to the German researcher who elucidated the famous honeybee dance. And that honeybee dance is this figure eight bodily movement that bees make in the dark that communicates very precisely the distance and direction of a resource. Normally, those resources are the pollen and nectar that they're eating to recruit nest mates to those same sources so that they can continue to forage on them. But in this particular case that Colleen was mentioning, is nest sites is also another resource. And so scout bees on these swarm clusters will venture out from the hive, find these potential new places to live, come back, and then literally debate amongst each other using this dance language. And then, unlike Congress, they arrive at a consensus and then make that decision collectively and then fly off to their new home. So it's been very well described and understood, and it's one of the reasons why we're just so fascinated by honeybees.
Recently, the Smithsonian reported on a study that seems to show bees have mathematical abilities, like simple addition and subtraction, and understand the concept of zero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, honeybees, because they're out there foraging in such a complex environment, they're surprisingly really good at learning. They can learn human faces. They can learn how to navigate mazes and complex landscapes. They're just very adept at that. And so researchers have been able to utilize that plasticity of them to be able to test different hypotheses about very fundamental questions, like, do they understand the concept of zero? Can they add integers together and those kind of things? And the answer is yes, that they can do that. And it just shows how one reason why they're just so successful ecologically, by being able to navigate 50 square miles of real estate and lock into the best food sources available in that area, and then bring it back to their nest for their family.
Colleen Higgins, do you feel, and I don't mean to anthropomorphize the bees here, but Professor Tarpey just told us they can recognize human faces. So What kind of relationship do you have with your bees? And when you start to walk towards the hive, do they say, oh, here comes Colleen?
Or, well, I know when I look in there, sometimes they're all looking at me.
Wow. Do you, in all seriousness, do you feel like you ever develop a relationship with the colony?
I'm not sure about that, but I definitely know that each colony is its own personality. It seems to have its own feel about it, smell about it, which is quite interesting.
Want to ask briefly, I told you before the show I have neighbors who keep bees, and mm-hmm. when he mows the lawn, he has to get decked out in full beekeeper regalia with the hat and the net and the thick clothing and all of it, because the bees get so aggressive. And the people who own the bees can't quite figure out why they're so aggressive and why they come after him when he mows the lawn. Do you have ideas about that?
I think the noise does bother them. And I think that if you get very close, honeybees or hives are safe to have in your yard. Certainly you want to stay away from the front of the hive where they come in and go out. They usually come out and go up, so, you know, you try to stay away from the very front. The smells of the gas, the combustion of the lawnmower, those are things that they don't particularly like. Time of day may depend on it.
And Africanized honeybees, we just have a minute or so left, but is that something that you can explain to us, Professor Tarpey? Are Africanized bees more aggressive?
Well, no honeybees are aggressive. They're only defensive of their nests. So even Africanized bees, which are notorious for their proclivity to sting people, they're just defensive of their nest. So when bees are out flying around flowers, they have nothing really to defend, and so unless you actively try and swat at it, they're not going to sting you. But when you disturb their home, they can be defensive. Now, Africanized bees being kind of tropically adapted, there's a lot more things that want to eat their honey, so they tend to have a heightened defense response than those deriving from Europe. But luckily, we don't have to deal with that here in North Carolina, at least not yet. But they may be introduced someday. So we're always on the lookout for that as a beekeeping community.
Mosquito spraying has been an issue for beekeepers in the past. Colleen Higgins, what can beekeepers do to protect their hives from mosquito sprayers?
Right now, you can sign up to have them shut off the sprayers in your area. What you have to do, though, is you have to have permission from your neighbors in order to do that. So if you want your area to be on the no spray, you've got to get the permission from your surrounding neighbors to do that.
You're listening to Coastline. Professor Tarpey, what can happen if, for instance, our neighbors couldn't get permission from the other folks who wanted to have the mosquito sprayers come through? What does that mean for their colony? Does it mean it's doomed?
Well, not necessarily, but it could. And this is where the balance between, you know, beneficial insects and pest insects start to collide, and the rights of the beekeepers versus the rights of the homeowners and their neighbors start to collide. And so it can get really complex and very situational. Usually with communication and understanding, you know, most people are not malicious to honeybees and they want to protect them, but if they also want to reduce the mosquitoes and the public health threats that those might provide, then something needs to be done. Unfortunately, what's good at killing off an adult mosquito is usually pretty good at killing off an adult honeybee as well. So there needs to be a balance of that. A lot of times with these mosquito abatement programs or just trying to address mosquitoes, they fly at dawn and dusk, and honeybees just really fly during the day. And so mosquito spraying at night allows for the mosquitoes to be exposed to a particular insecticide, but it allows the rest of the evening hours, the night hours, for that active ingredient to break down before the bees resume their foraging. So things like that can go a long way to trying to have our cake and eat it too when it comes to protecting pollinators, but then also addressing these other societal needs.
And you have also talked about royal jelly as being a possible factor in making bees stronger, creating super queens.
Oh, yes. Actually, some of our research has been to look at how beekeepers may be able to augment the royal jelly, which is the special food that is fed to developing queens rather than the workers. So workers are just kind of stunted, sterile daughters of the mother queen. But when the colony
that
comes
sounds
to
so
make,
denigrating.
Well, that's how they live together as a functional unit. It's just one big matrilineal family, really, is what a honeybee colony is. But when it comes time to make the next generation of queens, the daughter queens of that mother queen are fed royal jelly by their sisters. And that royal jelly, it turns out, is very potent, obviously. It can turn a worker into a queen just because of the extra nutritional proteins and sugars and other things that are in that royal jelly diet. And we've been able to tweak that diet a little bit to actually make queens bigger. We're not sure if they're better, but at least they're bigger than what queens are made in a normal hive environment. So we're exploring that to see if bigger and presumably better queens may also live longer and be more fecund and therefore help the beekeepers and the honeybees. So that's ongoing research that we're actively engaged in.
And just to be clear, you don't know yet if bigger is better. You don't know what bigger means for a queen bee.
Correct. I mean, there must be an upper limit. You know, queens stick their abdomens in the wax, the honeycomb, in order to lay eggs. So if they're too big, they simply can't fit into the cells. So there probably is an upper limit. But we are going to explore that, especially because queen loss is a really top management concern. It kind of doesn't rise to the same level as some of those other issues that beekeepers are dealing with, but queens aren't—they're supposed to live 2, 3, 4 years, but they seem only to be living about a year or so now compared to what they had been in the past. So queen longevity is certainly a management issue among beekeepers, and so if this technique may be able to counterbalance that, then that could go a long way to improving honeybee management.
Colleen Higgins, in the minute or so we have left, if someone had never kept bees before but wanted to try it out, what's the best way to start?
There are several places in Wilmington that do beekeeping schools. New Hanover County Beekeepers do a school. We're just finishing up this week on our school that started in February. I think Cape Fear Community College does one. I think UNCW has done some. Probably, I would suggest hanging with somebody who's a beekeeper or coming to the monthly meetings. We try to make them as educational as possible and cover different topics. And we always are trying to work on our mentorship program. So,
and approximately how much might it cost
The
first year? Is that a tough question?
A lot. Yeah,
it's an expensive hobby.
Initially, it is, because you have to get all the equipment. And as my husband would say, you also need a building and you need a freezer and, you know, all these things you don't have to have, but makes it a little easier. But your initial investment with your equipment, which is not going to be continuing, it's the initial.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Colleen Higgins, Professor David Tarpey, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thanks
so much. It was a lot of fun.
Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our web and social media master. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.